This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. Today we're joined by John Updike, the American writer of novels, short stories, poems, and essays. Mr. Updike turned 68 on March 18th, and he's had a spectacular career. Literary critics place him in the company of great writers such as William Faulkner and Ernest Hemingway. His work has been daring in taking on the central topics of love, faith, and meaning in modern America. Updike usually sets those powerful themes inside the American family, most notably in his series of novels about the life of Harry Rabbit Angstrom, the one-time high school basketball star who struggles with growing up, losing his star status, a troubled marriage, adultery, and dealing with children. These books constitute, in the words of one admirer, a, quote, saga of middle-class America in the second half of the 20th century. While John Updike has won two Pulitzer Prizes as well as the National Book Award, critics have questioned him for not addressing history and issues outside the family, such as social movements. Specifically, critics have questioned Mr. Updike's portrayal of women. In his latest novel, Gertrude and Claudius, John Updike deals with a woman who is both a full-blooded character and one with historical dimension, Gertrude, the wife of Shakespeare's King Hamlet. As fans of Shakespeare will recall, Gertrude falls in love with the king's brother, Claudius. The king is then killed by his brother, who also marries the queen and takes the throne. These events fall heavily on young Hamlet, who endlessly ponders avenging his father's death, an act that would require him to kill a man who is his mother's lover and his uncle. In Gertrude and Claudius, John Updike writes about the events that precede the Shakespearean play. In taking on literary history and a major female character, he's addressed some of the complaints of his critics, and his portrayal of this female protagonist has won praise. The New York Times said he has created a genuinely compelling character, a woman who is by turns vulnerable and outspoken, daring and naive. John Updike joins us from our New York bureau. Thank you for being on our show, Mr. Updike.
No, my pleasure.
If you want to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. To send an email, you can write to us at totn@npr.org. Please include at least your first name and where it is you're writing from. John Updike, I wanted to start by saying, I guess, happy birthday. It's coming up soon.
Thank you. A little early, but I'll accept that.
That's good enough. I noticed in reading about you that you were born in Shillington, Pennsylvania. And yes. I have no idea where that is.
Well, it's 3 miles outside of Reading, Pennsylvania. And if you don't know where that is,
I do that's know
a,
that.
Oh, right. It's a, you know, it's southeastern Pennsylvania in the middle of a county, Bricks County, full of farms and industry, both of which are changing. A very pretty county, somewhat conservative. My father wound up there as a school teacher, so I was a school teacher's son in a small town.
An only child?
An only child.
Of a math teacher, which surprised me given that you are a literary figure.
He taught math, but my mother was a very literary woman. She both read and tried to write, and in fact did write, and in the middle of her life got some things published. So that's where the literary quality comes from, the literary genes.
Literary genes. The other thing that surprised me in looking at your life was the notion that you wanted to be a cartoonist and that you had gone off to Oxford, England, in fact, to the Ruskin School of Drawing and Fine Arts after graduating summa cum laude from Harvard.
I'd always drawn, you know, how children do it, very primitive at first, and then you copy comic strips, and I wanted to be a cartoonist, yes. I wanted to be a comic strip artist, and then the New Yorker magazine came into our house, and I thought it'd be nice to do those funny cartoons. So I was an avid student of the art of cartooning and went to Harvard in part because the Harvard Lampoon was on that scene, and I really got onto the Lampoon as a cartoonist and not as a writer. But the writing, in the course of my 4 years at college, the writing kind of took over, became the stronger hand, and I went to art school really as one more dance, in a way, with my artistic side.
So let's come now to Gertrude and Claudius, your latest book. Why take the risk of approaching a Shakespearean play?
Well, writing is risk, especially novel writing, where every attempt is something of a departure. For many years, it struck me that the case for Gertrude and Claudius isn't made very completely in the Shakespeare play, that there's a lot we don't know about how they got together. Hamlet's anger at his mother seems overdetermined, and she's generally played by actresses past first prime, but in a very genteel and lovely way. She's one of two females in the play. And as I've always been in love with her in a mild way, I've always thought she, I mean, just if I may, I'll just read the first six lines she speaks in the play. She
says, please do.
You have to excuse my male voice. Good Hamlet, Hamlet is, you know, there in mourning ostentatiously. Good Hamlet, cast thy knighted color off, and let thine eye look like a friend on Denmark. Do not forever with thy veiled lids seek for thy noble father in the dust. Thou know'st 'tis common. All that lives must die, passing through nature to eternity. Now, aren't those wise and graceful and motherly words all at once? True. How can you not love a woman like that?
That, right. Well, what, you know, I guess having seen the play many times, certain things nonetheless stood out for me in reading your book. One is the notion that Gertrude was married so young.
I don't know what young was in the Middle Ages. It might have been younger than we think, like 15. There are a lot of arranged marriages, which went on. So I couldn't quite do that to her, but I did have her get married at 17 and a mother by the age of 18, yes. We know, one of the few things we do know from the play about Hamlet is that he was 30 years old, which is surprising since he seems rather younger.
Yes.
So if he's 30, she must be in her late 40s, a fairly mature heroine. And a fairly mature woman to fall in love, as she apparently does with the evil Claudius.
And King Hamlet is drawn in your book as a rather distant, cold husband-father figure, as if he's more engaged in being a corporate leader than being a loving person.
Well, that's how I saw him, and there's nothing in the play that would really gainsay that. I tried, by the way, to make my novel as consistent with the play as I could. At the same time, it has to be, you know, it's an invented piece of imaginative work. But yes, Hamlet was a king, first and foremost. He was ambitious, and his marriage to young Princess Gertrude advanced that ambition, so that she was, as a teenager, a pawn, as I think women in the Middle Ages tended to be, especially high-born women, a pawn in the hands of men. Her father liked Hamlet and wanted her to marry him.
So she felt some responsibility, and from this very young age is trapped. And so when she breaks out of this, it's with Claudius in terms of feeling for the first time in her life true love.
You could say that. In fact, you have said that, and very nicely, too. Claudius isn't around. You're trying to imagine what has Claudius been doing all these years before the play Hamlet opens. I could only think that he was traveling, fighting abroad. The people of the Middle Ages were a lot more widespread than we think. They're a lot more mobile than we tend to think. And so I posited for him a kind of romantic career in the south of Europe, being a knight errant. And in love with Gertrude fairly early on, but also very competitive with his brother all of his life. So who knows if his love is a totally pure, or is it part a wish to take something from your brother. But yes, he loves her long before she admits him to her bed and before she loves him.
One of the things that stays with me, though, is that she is a thoroughly sympathetic character as you've drawn her. There's no sense in which you would say, I want to condemn Gertrude for cheating on her husband. I didn't come away with that feeling at all in my heart.
No, well, maybe that's not a very modern feeling to want to condemn a woman for betraying her husband. My other heroines, some of them have betrayed their husbands. She was a woman looking for A, happiness, B, freedom, C, her real self, and in some way she feels that her real self was not fulfilled by the first marriage, so she goes with the brother who she thinks can deliver a reality, her own reality to her. Hamlet himself, young Hamlet, the Prince Hamlet, is so condemnatory of her misbehavior, as he construes it, that it wouldn't be up to me to add any condemnation to it. No, I wanted to see this from her side and Claudius's side.
In your previous works, the focus has often been on events inside the family, and so here we see it now taken into the context of this royal kingdom in Denmark. Is there a difference between, you know, late 20th century America and the situation that you draw here in the court of Hamlet?
I don't doubt that families operated very differently in the Middle Ages. But even Shakespeare was a relatively modern person. He was writing around 1600, after all, about events that took place, let's say, in around 1250. So he was adding a modernizing touch. And some of the reviewers have kidded me about turning Gertrude and Claudius into another suburban couple. I tried to soft-pedal that. I tried to keep their diction more or less in keeping with what they might say. But Hamlet is a domestic drama, after all. It's about, apparently, Oedipal feelings. It's about stepfathers and stepsons. It's there's a lot of family in it already. I didn't have to invent all that. There's a point beyond which you can't really imagine your way out of your own head. And I'm a late 20th century man, and of course, I ascribe to this couple suburban and sophisticated psychological feelings that I suspect they didn't really have abundantly in the Middle Ages.
Mr. Updike, could you explain to the listeners how you've handled the names in Gertrude and Claudius? Because the names change throughout the book, and at times it looks as if you've done historical research going back to look at 12th century Latin text so that you get it just right. Tell us what you're doing there.
Yeah, I didn't think it would be too confusing. My editor at Knopf did make me, or didn't make me, but she suggested that maybe a foreword explaining what I was about to do would be helpful. The legend of Hamlet is quite ancient. We don't quite know the first version it took, but it appears in a Latin text called Historia Danica, a late 12th century Latin text, in which this phenomenon of the prince who has to feign madness to escape being killed is described with the names that I used in my part one. The story was retold or translated, but really so freely and with so many additions that it amounts to a new version by a Frenchman called François de Belforêt or Forest. His names I used in the second part. They're rather similar. It's Garutha in one and Garutha in the next, and then Gertrude in the English. And in the third part, as we approach Shakespeare's play, we use Shakespeare's names. It's not so confusing in the case of Gertrude, really a matter of inflection. It is confusing in the name of, in the case of Claudius, who first appears as Feng or Fengon, and where Claudius came from, I don't know. But I tried to kind of cover that as I went along. So if the reader has stuck with me this far, he won't be thrown off the track.
One of the themes that I have come to admire in all your works is the notion of spiritualism or even sort of moral teachings. Is that apparent in Gertrude and Claudius?
There's certainly less of it than some of my other suburban studies of life. But I do discuss the Danes of that period as fairly recent converts to Christianity, and some of them not really converted at all. So that Gertrude's own sense of God and his laws is rather dim.
We're going to have to take our break for just a second, Mr. Updike. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. We're going to take a short break right now. When we return, we'll continue talking with author John Updike, and we'll take your calls at 800-989-8255. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can send us a card or letter. The address is Talk of the Nation, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., the zip code 20001. The email address is totn@npr.org. Please include your name and where you're writing from. Welcome back to Talk of the Nation. I'm Juan Williams. Here's a special program note. This year marks the 30th anniversary of NPR's founding. This Monday, NPR President and CEO Kevin Close will join Talk of the Nation to discuss the future of public radio and take calls from listeners. Be sure to tune in on Monday, March 13th, at this time, for a conversation with NPR President Kevin Close. Today we're talking with author John Updike, whose latest book is Gertrude and Claudius. If you want to join the conversation, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Mr. Updike, I wanted you to finish that thought about morality in Gertrude and Claudius.
Just that the standard Christian morality hasn't really settled into Denmark at this point in time. I'm not sure it ever did, in fact. The Scandinavian countries were the last to be converted to Christianity, in a sense, were the first to abandon it or to wander away from it. But no, there are some thoughts of guilt and so on that haunt Claudius more than Gertrude, really. Claudius is the one who's God-haunted, in a sense. The only Dane I really ever read much of was Kierkegaard, the philosopher and theologian, and he came from Jutland, as do these two brothers, and he describes his father's childhood as being God-haunted and tormented. And so a certain amount of Kierkegaard flavor got into my Denmark, but not much. These people still lived by the sword and often by treachery, so I'm not sure that that this particular case of adultery and whatever usurpation was so out of line as it would be now.
Mr. Updike, would you do us the honor of reading a little bit from your book, Gertrude and Claudius?
Let me just try the opening page so you get a little flavor of it. The king was irate. Each chapter, by the way, begins with that same sentence, although it's always a different king. The king was irate. His daughter, Gerutha, though but a plump 16, had voiced reluctance to marry the nobleman of his choice, Horwendel the Jute, a beefy warrior in every way suitable, if Jutes could ever suit in marriage a Zealand maiden born and reared in the royal castle of Elsinore. To disobey the king is treason, Rorik admonished his child, the roses in whose thin-skinned cheeks flared with defiance and distress. When the culprit is the realm's only princess, he went on, the crime becomes incestuous and self-injuring. In every way suitable to you, Gerutha said, pursuing her own instincts, shadows chased into the far corners of her mind by the regal glare her father cast. But I found him unsubtle. And then Rorik responds, unsubtle? He has all the warrior wit a loyal Dane needs. Horwendel slew the tormentor of our coasts, King Cole of Norway, by taking his long sword in two hands, thus bearing his own chest. But before he could be stabbed there, he shattered Cole's shield and cut off the Norseman's foot, so the blood poured clean out of him. And so forth. A mix here of the old barbarities, the cruelties by which men lived, and her own feminist feelings that in some way this arranged marriage isn't quite her thing, pursuing her own instincts, shadows chased into the far corners, etc. The whole novel, her whole involvement with Claudius is a matter of pursuing her own instincts.
Bill in Providence, Rhode Island, you're on Talk of the Nation with John Updike.
Yeah, I was wondering, Mr. Updike, if you could talk about how your novel contrast with Tom Stoppard's work, or if it was influenced by it, or...
Well, Tom Stoppard certainly broke ground as far as what you might call teasing Shakespeare, or reanimating Shakespeare. I saw Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are Dead, and then I read it again. Mine is a prequel. Stoppard's is really a play that takes place as the action of Shakespeare's play goes on. And Stoppard also finds, I think, a kind of Beckett-like, quasi-existential, clownish thread in poor Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, who are summoned they know not why, and then perish they know not why, and to whom the whole thing is a mystery, whereas I took a slightly less facetious approach and tried to seriously build the case for Claudius and Gertrude and to develop a plausible script for what might have happened in the years before the play opens.
Bill, thanks for your call. Let me go now to Bob in Monroe, North Carolina. Bob, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Updike, I've got a question for you. I heard that Juan Williams said in the beginning of the show that you were influenced maybe in your development of this character by maybe some of the criticisms that you had gotten earlier for not having a solid-based woman character. Is that true, or have you been thinking about this book for a while, and how did you develop Gertrude, And could you have done it if in the back of your mind you thought that the critics were thinking, we're going to really look at this one and make sure that this one meets our test? Can you talk to that for a moment?
Well, it's hard to know your own subconscious exactly. I myself plead not guilty to the charge of the women in my books being second-rate citizens. I didn't feel that when I write about them, and some of my books, the females really are quite in the foreground. And having grown up with a gifted mother and having married gifted women, I really am not conscious of any of these chauvinistic feelings to which have been by some critics ascribed to me. On the other hand, who knows why, but for some reason, writing from a woman's standpoint was very pleasing, and most of the pages in this book are about Gertrude rather than Claudius. But it is a mug's game, as T.S. Eliot said, to try to write to please critics, because your real critics can't be pleased, and you never can know quite what to do. And all you can do is try to be as true to your characters, give them as much life as you can, and try to see things from their side, even the villainous ones. I've written other books about women. The Witches of Eastwick was about women, after all, and mostly women, and a book called Marry Me was also had mostly female characters. So I don't feel the charge is very just, but I'm pleased to see that the critics, by and large, like Gertrude in this little novel.
Bob, thanks for your call. Let me ask you, Mr. Updike, as you think about the feminist movement, which developed clearly to new heights during the latter half of the last century, how would you describe the emergence of women in your books, since you believe that Witches of Eastwick and other books have featured strong female characters? Have they changed as a result of that feminist movement or not?
I think The Witches of Eastwick was an attempt to examine feminism as it then existed in the 70s. A lot of divorcees suddenly appeared in small towns, and they grouped together for lack of husbands and found strength and pleasure in their own company. This I observed as a truth and tried to dramatize it in the book. I think to some extent the feminist movement is about power, about taking power, whether it's job power or legal power, and the women have been, it's true enough, locked out of it. They only got the vote in 1920. It seems almost incredible. So that I've my women in the books notice these. Rabbit's wife, Janice Angstrom, is quite mousy and sad, really, in the first novel. But as the novels go on, she gets stronger and stronger and really, in the end, wins out and becomes the strong character. So if I keep using the word strong, it's because I think that feminism is to a great extent about power, about the power to lead your own life, the power to control your own decisions, that kind of thing, which in a way is what Gertrude and Claudius is about as well.
Arnie in Miami, Florida, you're on Talk of the Nation with John Updike.
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Professor, I look forward to reading your book. I was wondering, it's just a simple question, whether you thought that Gertrude knew in the play, the Shakespearean play, whether she knew that the murder had taken place or whether she partook in the murder, and if she didn't, what her reaction would have been had she found out how the king was killed.
Thanks for your call, Arnie.
My novel takes the position that she did not know. In fact, Claudius goes to some lengths to keep it from her and swears his conspirators, co-conspirators, not to tell the queen. And in the play, there's no evidence that I was able to see in several readings of it that she did know. She's not in on these plots, and the fact that she drinks the poison chalice at the end indicates that she's not in on Claudius's plots. Had she did known, of course, she was wife enough to King Hamlet to have been repulsed and horrified, and certainly would have not have married his brother.
Let me go here to Lori in Mesa, Arizona. Lori, you're on Talk of the Nation with John Updike.
Hi, thank you. I have not read the book yet, but I was fortunate enough to have had your father for a substitute teacher when I was in ninth grade.
Uh-huh.
And during the 2 weeks that he substituted our math class, he told such wonderful stories that he really didn't get around to the math itself. And at the end of the 2 weeks, he told the class that there's one lesson he wanted us to leave the class with, and that was as we'd go through life, people would walk on us. And that was okay, but never let anybody rub their feet. And interestingly enough, that is probably one of the few lessons that I've retained from ninth grade math into my adulthood. So I was just curious if your father, being such a great storyteller, if he was such an influence on you as being such a good storyteller yourself.
Excuse me, Lori. Did you know Mr. Updike's mother too?
No, I did not. I did not know his mother. But.
Right. Well, thanks for your call.
Lori, it's nice to hear you talk about my father. He was a dear man and a funny man and was a good storyteller indeed. I think he approached teaching as giving life lessons, and a lot of the classes he did seem to get distracted from the math into sharing what he had learned in life. He was sort of a graduate of the School of Hard Knocks. He'd had a tough childhood in Trenton, New Jersey. And he believed in teaching. He believed in it in the highest sense that an older man actually could tell kids something that they needed to know. And I was not only a student of his, but I was his child. And in the nicest possible way, he shared his life lessons with me, too. So there's no real accounting for me of how much my father figures into my worldview, but certainly a lot of it in a book like The Centaur couldn't have been written without him in mind.
Merlin in Portland, Oregon, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi.
I have a question for Mr. Updike. I should preface by saying that I'm a young writer at the beginning of my career. Simon & Schuster published my very first novel last summer. It's called Careful What You Wish For, in case anyone wants to know. And what I'm working on now is a novel that retells several stories, including in one section Hamlet from Gertrude's point of view. So I was very interested to read your take on that. I wanted to ask, I know you've covered the topic of marital infidelity before, and how do you go over the same sort of emotional ground without writing the same novel over and over again?
Thanks for your call, Merlin.
Well, Merlin, maybe you don't quite avoid going over the same ground again, but it seems to the writer, you're a writer, so you would know this, it seems when you're excited by any project or any page or any sentence, indeed, that this has never quite been said before. Certainly I've written about adultery and betrayal and the complex feelings within a marriage, but never, I thought, quite in the way that Shakespeare's characters enabled me to get at the fact that they were his characters and that the plot was, in a sense, handed to me, forced me to think in unexpected ways. As to how do you, as a young writer, avoid repeating yourself, I wouldn't worry about it. I would just put all your heart and soul into the book at hand and let the future take care of itself.
I'm Juan Williams, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mr. Updike, when you think about the notion that maybe Gertrude didn't know that Claudius was involved with the murder of her husband, isn't that a statement about her inability to truly see his character?
Well, it doesn't speak well, maybe, for her abilities as a detective. It's also possible that she didn't want to know. Shakespeare doesn't make very much of this. There's never a scene in which she quizzes him about what really went on in the orchard or why did my husband die so strangely. I think miracles of various kinds, including sudden death, were taken for granted in the Middle Ages, and that the story that he was bitten by a poisonous adder and while sleeping in the orchard wasn't so very strange that she need be suspicious. In any case, it certainly would not have suited my rosy picture of her to have her be an accomplice in murder, her husband's murder at that. And it's within his male character, I think, to try to shelter her from the dirty deeds that needs to be done. In my novel, it perhaps isn't too much to say The king knows that she's been cheating on him and is going to do something bad to all of them, and so Claudius acts in part to defend her, to protect her. Her very first words to him upon succumbing were, "Protect me." She knew handing herself over to, sleeping with another man for a queen meant death in those days, and so she knew she was playing for big stakes.
Must have produced heightened sexual pleasure, though. Is there a sense of that?
I wonder. You wonder what those people did for sexual pleasure, or it's fairly mysterious, so there are a few hints. Yes, I suppose. I think, in general, what modern people have lost that the earlier people knew was the sense that death might be just around the corner from one way or another. A knight might come along and cut off your head, or some strange disease might lay you low. And we pretty well insulated ourselves from the sense that each moment might be the last, whereas they really had it, and I think that their behavior was correspondingly reckless often, because they thought they better live intensely now. There might not be a tomorrow.
I remember that Rabbit Angstrom's wife, though, she only learns to discover pleasure in sex later in life. But that's not the case here with Gertrude.
Gertrude is pretty old. Gertrude's 48, don't forget, or 47, okay. I guess, when they first begin to sleep together. And she doesn't say that she never had any pleasure with the late King Hamlet. She just says that Claudius opens up parts of her she didn't know were there. I think that I'm no gynecologist, but it seems to me that often a woman's sexual ability to respond comes on well after a man's does, maybe in her 30s, even 40s. That's just a guess, but it is my guess.
Let's take a call here from Moira in Minneapolis. Moira, I'm going to ask you to hold on for just a second.
Sure.
Let me read this for you, which says that you're listening to Talk of the Nation, and I'm Juan Williams. We're going to take a short break right now. When we return, we'll continue talking with author John Updike, and we'll take more of your calls at 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to comment on the program, please write to Talk of the Nation, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001. The email address, totn@npr.org. Please include your name and where you're writing from. Today we're talking with author John Updike. If you want to join the conversation, our number here is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Moira in Minneapolis, thanks for waiting.
Great. I get the station break so I can get even more nervous. Okay. Hello. My name is Moira. I'm a cartoonist, and I'm a big fan of John Dempsey and Dana Pirot. Matter of fact, I'm doing a cartoon novel of that musical, and I was wondering, Mr. Updike, if you're excited about their musical of your book, Witches of Eastwick.
Thanks for your call, Moira.
You're welcome.
Moira, it's not very real to me. I know that it's supposed to be happening, and occasionally I get little scraps of information about it, but I've had so many would-be play adaptations or movies that didn't come to fruition, that never actually produced a product, that I'm kind of just hoping for the best on this. As to my excitement, I think there are elements of a musical comedy in the Witches of Eastwick. In some way, it's an operatic book. The witches could sing. I suppose the devil can sing. The plot is pretty melodramatic and colorful. It all depends really on the execution. And as for that, we'll all have to wait and see.
All right. Frederick in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Updike. I wondered whether he was familiar with three plays by Percy Mackay, who was a well-known Shakespearean actor of the previous generation, which are prequels to Hamlet, a sequence of prequels. And if so, whether he had been influenced in any way by these plays in his version of the proceedings.
Well, I'm embarrassed to say I'm not. And had I known that these prequels, other prequels, existed, I might not have written my own, So sometimes ignorance is bliss, or at least a spur to creativity. Hamlet, of all the Shakespearean plays, I think invites this kind of attention. One wants to know more. There are a lot of gaps and mysteries in the play that cry out for illumination, and it's not surprising that it's attracted a lot of... And also, every production is different, depending on where the emphasis is going to be, how sexy, for example, should the scene with the queen and her son be in the closet, that kind of thing. So you get a great range of interpretations of a play that retains its mystery, a little like the Mona Lisa. It's almost the Mona Lisa of plays.
Frederick, what did you think of the ones by Percy MacKay, as you said?
Yeah, I haven't read them, unfortunately, but I met the author in about 1949, and he talked to me about them a little bit. I was impressed with the language and so on, but I have no idea really what the contents would be, and I don't know what happened to these plays after they were written, whether they were ever published in easily available form.
Well, I'd never heard of
them,
but then there's a lot I haven't heard of. That's an interesting thought, though.
All right, David in Ann Arbor. David, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, I had a question for Mr. Updike. I was just wondering why none of the names in Hamlet seem to fit with the nationalities of the character. Like, you have a bunch of dames with names like Ophelia and Claudius.
Thanks for your call, David.
David, I don't know. You'd have to ask Shakespeare, and he's kind of hard to get for this sort of show. But Rosencrantz and Guildenstern actually are apparently the names of aristocratic Danes. So to that extent, Shakespeare did take a leaf from the Danish reality. But who knows? The names perhaps had to be names that wouldn't be too hard for the Elizabethan audience to grasp. They might have been names built into the play. There was an earlier Hamlet, as you know, perhaps by Thomas Kidd, and Shakespeare's company bought the rights to it. They weren't called rights then. But so Shakespeare may have been dealing with names that had been, to some extent, already bestowed. But as I say, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern actually are Danish names.
All right. John in Chicago, Illinois, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello, Mr. Updike. I gotta say, it's really loud where I'm at. I am ashamed to say that up till 2 years ago, I was not literary whatsoever until my wife bought me the Rabbit Angstrom Tetralogy. And I sat and looked at it for 2 months, intimidated as hell, and eventually got into it and plowed through it in 2 months, and it's really changed my life, and I've become an avid reader since then. I have a very general question of how do you approach your novels in a real general sense of, in your own words, how you do your research and prepare, and if you could specifically talk about the Rabbit Angstrom process versus something like Roger's version. And then one other side question is, was Leopold Bloom at all in the back of your mind when you were dealing with Harry Angstrom?
Thanks for your call, Jim.
That's a lot of questions. I'll answer the last one first. He might have been to some extent. It's hard to know what's in your mind. The idea of a wandering kind of everyman. Harry isn't Jewish, but in many ways he's an outsider to the society he's in. The germ of it is that there were a lot of former basketball players in my environment while growing up in Pennsylvania, a lot of men whose lives were effectively over when they were 18 and who spent the rest of their lives looking for the magic of being an athletic hero, so that Rabbit was meant to exemplify that kind of American male. And the first book was meant to stand alone. It was the portrait of this kind of man making a mess of his marriage, making a mess of his life, and other people's lives, too, not just his own. But then 10 years later, I had nothing else to do, couldn't think of a better thing to do than to bring him back. And so I did bring him back in 10-year intervals, and that's why there's that book that you've plowed through so manfully. That's why the book is so big. You try to give your best to every character, but I must say that that character and his colleagues and the environment, being my own really childhood environment, boyhood environment, always feel especially warm to me. So it was a pleasure in a way to write those books, and I think some of that pleasure shows through for the reader. As to research, there wasn't too much involved in the Rabbit books, clearly. There's a little. I did go to Florida for one of the books and look Florida over to get some field notes for it. A book like Roger's version does require a lot of research, which is pleasant. If you enjoyed being a student, it's a way of prolonging your student era. But in the end, you hope that the book takes on a kind of human life, that the characters' problems and their decisions and their indecisions are vivid enough so that they carry the research along with them. You don't want to write a book that just looks like animated research.
Mr. Updike, do you watch any of these TV afternoon shows where people come on and say that, you know, they've been sleeping with their aunt and all the rest? And does that strike you as the modern equivalent of what Shakespeare did by producing Hamlet, that soap opera quality?
Well, we are interested in each other's lives. So we're born alone. Our parents tell us something. Our siblings and classmates tell us something. But I think we're interested in fiction or this kind of talk show because we're basically interested in what life is like for other people. And Shakespeare's plays abundantly try to demonstrate what life is like for those people. And so you could say that the same interest is present in both all these forms of narrative, from the kind of talk show you described to the most abstruse and carefully written piece of fiction now, all pander to our curiosity. I'm curious and have tried in the novels and fiction in a way to share a little of what I've learned, and I've only learned, of course, a little. Life is among us like an elephant, and we're trying to report our little part of it in the hopes of making the picture bigger for everybody.
But you wouldn't look down on those shows. You said sort of literature and the shows pander is, I think, what you said, right?
Pander's the word. Maybe that's an unkind word. And they cater was like the word cater better. I don't watch them, but maybe that's my failing. It does sound kind of trashy, and you wonder about the impulse to get on TV at the risk of humiliating, at the certain possibility of humiliating yourself. But people are very hungry to make a mark in life. I've tried to make a mark with writing, a relatively sedate attempt, and if you can only make your mark by getting on and saying you slept with your wife's aunt or whatever else you need to say now, the stakes are going up, of course, in shock value. And right. Sleeping with your wife's aunt monkey might be the thing, or parrot would be, I think, exciting still on these talk shows. But I don't disdain them. I think they're, people should be allowed to watch what interests them, and if that interests them, this is a democracy, and go to it.
Michael in San Jose, California, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a quick question, Mr. Updike. I hope I can make it quick without meandering. The intrigue and the beauty with the stage plays is in the hands of a skillful actor and director, the subtle nuances and interpretations like you spoke of with the scene in the closet between Hamlet and Gertrude can greatly affect an audience's own interpretation of the work. I was curious on how you came to make your own interpretations because in a novel, you really have to take a stand when you do an interpretation, from the simple thing of how somebody's looking or what they're meaning behind the words as they say them, the thought process. And I was wondering, did you have any second guesses or second thoughts when you would look at various ways to interpret these characters and their outcomes?
All right, Michael, thanks for your call. I'm Juan Williams, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Mr. Updike, please respond.
An answer to Michael, insofar as I can answer it. You try to make these decisions, of course, before you begin the novel, where you want to begin, what you want to say, why you're writing it. Clearly, I wrote it from a very strong pro-Gertrude position. I loved Gertrude. I wanted to make her the heroine of Hamlet, in a way. Claudius, I didn't have as big an emotional stake in, but I wanted to show him as the case for Claudius and what kind of man, intelligent man, and also that the Hamlets, both father and son, weren't all that great. The one is the younger one is a terrible self-centered whiner, and the older one, who we know mostly as a ghost, is kind of a public man of that era and something of a bully. So those were my interpretations, and I sent about animating them as best I could. Talking about the stage interpretations, a novel isn't really open to that kind of manipulation. The author has to do it all. The author is everything. He's the set designer, he's the makeup artist, he's all the actors, and he's the director too. So one of the reasons I've never tried to write plays is that I don't want them to be at the mercy of so many other people. I'd like the product to be my own.
One last thing, Mr. Updike, I've only got about 30 seconds left, so I ask you to be brief. One of our callers, who I didn't get on the air, asked, what writers influenced you, and at what point did you find your own voice?
Well, I'm still looking for my own voice, but Marcel Proust and an English novelist called Henry Green, an American writer called James Thurber, and of course Hemingway, and to a lesser extent Faulkner, whom I find somewhat intimidating, Cheever and Salinger of the New Yorker School in general, Eudora Welty, a whole host of writers, but Proust and Henry Green foremost.
That's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank all of you who called this hour and wrote, and I'd especially like to thank my guest, John Updike. His latest book is called Gertrude and Claudius. He joined us from our New York bureau. Talk of the Nation is produced by Alan Silva, directed by Arun Rath. The production staff includes Sese Modope Fadope, Susan Lund, Devin Robbins, Sesko Sato, and Justine Kennan. Brian Jarbo is the technical director, with Andrea Jackson-Guritz, with engineering support from Sue Klein, Mitch Eaton, and Jack Gandy in Washington, and Neil Rausch and Chris Sotsky in New York. We had help from program librarians Denise Chin, Giselle Foss, Tom Tuzinski, and Catherine Baer, and music librarian Robert Goldstein. Greg Allen is our executive producer. Remember, it's 2 weeks till our March Book Club of the Year. You still have plenty of time to read Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. It's a guide to 13,000 years of human history and attempts to explain how human societies ended up with the distribution of wealth and resources we see today. So again, the book is Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, and we'll be talking about it on Thursday, March 23rd, 2 weeks from today. In Washington, I'm Juan Williams, NPR News.